Ave podcast listeners, a quick notice. To celebrate the 10th year of the Emperors of Rome, we will be holding a live podcast and special screening of the hit movie Gladiator. It's on Saturday, 19th of October at 4:30 p.m. at the Thornbury Picture House in Melbourne. Tickets are on sale now on their website, and at the time of recording this, there are only 4 seats left, so get in quick. There's a link in the podcast notes. We hope to see you there. Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Associate Professor Kaelin Davenport, Head of the Centre for Classical Studies at the Australian National University. This is episode CCXXX, Emperor Tacitus. That's right, we now return to the late 3rd century, where the Emperor Aurelian has finally reunited the Roman Empire and been murdered for his trouble, and the Senate in Rome, waning in its influence, makes a final flex of power. Here's Kaelin Davenport. We've just had the death of Emperor Aurelian,
yes,
the man who reunited the Roman Empire from its 3 fractured parts. And at the time, he was possibly leading an army towards confronting the Sassanids. And while in Thrace, and this is only one of the possibilities, he was killed by a high-ranking official or high-ranking officials who were concerned that they'd been implicated in corruption. And I think the Historia Augusta pointed out that there was a death list that had been discovered.
That's right.
A la Domitian.
You know, exactly.
Kind of like echoes of Domitian's death.
Yes.
No, I was going to point out the Domitian parallel, but...
See, I listened to the previous episode, so I know what you're going to say about it. And at this point, we get the Senate appointing an emperor, which is the last time this happens. I think the Senate flexes their muscles in this way.
Well, there is debate about this and even the identity of the next emperor, whether he is a senator or whether he is a military officer, and then also whether he's chosen by the Senate or by the army. There's debate in the modern scholarship today.
Okay, so take me through that a bit then. How did the Roman Empire, I guess, react to the death of Aurelian? And if the Senate did make this move, why did the army not? I'm so used to the army appointing the next general in space.
Yes. So you would think that when Aurelian is murdered, you know, his troops, his officers around him would acclaim the next emperor. And that has been the pattern that has happened throughout the succeeding decades. However, we're specifically told in 2 sources, in both the Latin tradition represented by the Historia Augusta and also the Greek tradition represented by Zonarus, that the next emperor, Marcus Claudius Tacitus, was actually in Campania when he was acclaimed emperor. So Campania, this is southern Italy, you know, this is where Pompeii is, where Naples is, where a lot of senators have villas. So he's not actually placed with the troops. To complicate things further, there's also this story about a 6-month interregnum. So after Aurelian's death, no one was proclaimed. And I think if there had been someone on hand in Thrace when Aurelian was murdered, we would have heard about it. There would be some trace of that in the sources, not these ideas of this confused period when there was no emperor. Now, historians have said, you know, if there was an interregnum, it would only have been for, you know, probably 6 weeks to 2 months, not 6 months. Even more fancifully, there's this idea that Aurelian's wife, Ulpia Severina, was controlling the government in this period. I don't believe this. It's not because I don't think women could exert power or anything like that. It's because the evidence is so flimsy. It's based on sort of coin emissions, which some people have dated coins being minted for Ulpia Severina in the last months of 275. And the evidence for that is quite flimsy as well. So it's very probable that Tacitus was acclaimed in Italy, that he was residing in Campania where he was summoned, but he could have been summoned by the Senate or by the army, that is the Praetorian Guard.
Okay.
Despite all that, though, was there an interregnum? Was there a lag of time?
There was probably a short lag of time. I would say probably about 6 weeks to 2 months between Aurelian's murder and Tacitus's acclamation. So Tacitus, we know, is made emperor. And this is based on papyri, around inscriptions, in about November, December 275. And Aurelian was probably murdered in September, October. So there is a bit of a gap on current evidence. And again, I think this reflects the fact there was no one on the scene in Thrace who was acclaimed emperor.
Yeah.
Because if there was someone on the scene in Thrace, if Tacitus was there, then they would have sent out letters immediately to all the provinces and his recognition would have been very fast. But the fact that there is this gap shows that there was probably a period of negotiation, discussion about who the next emperor would be.
Do we know anything about the selection process? Rome's got a really bad history when it comes to selecting emperors in this fashion. I remember there being an auction by the Praetorian Guards, at one point.
Yes, that's good old Didius Julianus in 193.
About the Septimius Severus kind of time. I think Septimius Severus won out in that argument. But yeah.
That's right.
So what was the selection process like for this?
Well, so again, there's two versions. So one is given by the Historia Augusta is that, you know, Marcus Claudius Tacitus is a senator. He is the sort of princeps senatus figure, so the leader of the Senate, and he's in the Senate, and he is acclaimed by the upper senators. That's one version. The other version, which is given both by the Historia Augusta as an alternative and by Zenarus in the Greek tradition, is that a delegation had to go to Campania to summon Tacitus. But in both stories, there's the idea that he declined the honour. You know, that's what good emperors do. You know, you don't want to be emperor there. That features in the historical tradition as well.
Okay, so kind of like Caesar turning down the laurel wreath.
Exactly, exactly, yes. And, you know, Tiberius, you know, what, not wanting to
do any work.
Not wanting to do any work. Yes, that's one way of putting it, yes. So the idea of the interregnum comes through in the Historia Augusta, where the author writes, and this is the Life of Tacitus, Chapter 2, "And so the Senate and people of Rome passed through an unusual and difficult situation, namely that for 6 months, while a good man was being sought, the Commonwealth had no emperor. What harmony there was then amongst the soldiers! What peace for the people! How full of weight the authority of the Senate! Nowhere did any pretender arise, and the judgment of the Senate, the soldiers, and the people of Rome guided the entire world. It was not because they feared any emperor or the power of a tribune that they did righteously, but, what is the noblest thing in life, because they feared themselves." So I guess they feared their own ambition.
Okay, all right. It sounds like HA is a fan.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, as certainly, you know, anyone with knowledge of Roman history or, you know, people who've been listening to this podcast would know, you know, this is so implausible that there would be absolutely no competition for 6 months. That wouldn't happen at all.
So what do we know about his background then? You've said that there's arguments that he was a senator and he... It sounds like he was because he was appointed by the Senate and he was around there, but that doesn't mean that he's not a general and a soldier as well.
Exactly. So the ancient sources emphasize that he was an ex-consul. We see this in the Latin tradition represented by Aurelius Victor and the Historia Augusta, whereas the Greek tradition, you know, emphasize how old he is. He's 75. And so there's this idea that he was an illustrious elderly senator. However, Ronald Syme, an illustrious scholar of Roman history in the Historia Augusta, suggested that Tacitus was actually a member of the Danubian military elite. So this, you know, military elite from whom Claudius Gothicus and Aurelian emerged. Valiant fighters, they're on the scene, you know, they're commanding armies from the front. And this sort of put the cat amongst the pigeons because many scholars found this a very plausible thesis, the idea that, you know, after Gallienus, you know, we don't have any more senatorial emperors. And this is linked, of course, to the decision not to appoint senators in direct command of troops, which happened under Gallienus. However, I see the situation somewhat differently. Firstly, none of the sources mention that Tacitus was from this sort of core of Illyrian generals. They always pointed out when someone is, you know, Aurelian, Claudius Gothicus, Probus, Diocletian, who will meet in future episodes. Secondly, you know, if he's 75, he could plausibly be a member of this last generation of senatorial generals, those that were still commanding armies in the 240s under Philip, in the 250s under Valerian. And if you look at the epigraphic evidence, the inscriptions that record careers, we do find many of these generals, you know, going on to serve as consul or urban prefect in the 270s. And the 280s.
Okay, yeah.
It's very controversial, but I would propose that he was definitely a senator. And this reflects the fact that after the murder of Gallienus, after the decision to exclude senators from the direct command of troops, there is a period of negotiation, of back and forth. And eventually the, you know, Illyrian military elite emerges victorious, but we're still in this uncertain stage here.
I am swayed by that argument, I think, personally. But
thank you, Matt.
I'm not Ronald Syme, but I find that it's such a notable thing to be from that area and to be of that kind of distinction.
Yes.
That if he was, they would have mentioned it.
Exactly, exactly, which they do with all the others.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, sure. Okay, yeah.
Thank you. I will add that to my CV.
And very appropriate given today's political climate. But was there a problem or an issue with making somebody as old as Tacitus is the emperor?
Well, according to the Historia Augusta, there is a debate in the Senate about his age. And so we have a senator who is called Micius Faltonius Nicomachus, who gives a speech, the HA. Now, the speech is almost certainly fictitious, but it's interesting to reflect on this discourse about elderly rulers in ancient Rome, because it could go two ways. On one hand, you know, they're wise, you know, they're men of experience. On the other hand, they're old and foolish and have lost the plot, essentially.
Well, they're also expected during this time as well, to a large extent, to lead the army.
Exactly.
I can't imagine a 75-year-old leading an army into battle against the Sassanids.
This is what they were debating at that time. Nicomachus says, and this is chapter 6 of the life of Tacitus, "Always indeed, conscript fathers, had this noble body taken wise and prudent measures for the commonwealth, and from no nation in the whole world has sounder wisdom ever been awaited. At no time has a more wise or more weighty opinion been voiced in this sacred place. We have chosen a prince, a man of advanced in years, one who will watch over all like a father. From him we need fear nothing ill-considered, nothing over-hasty, nothing cruel. All his actions, we may predict, will be earnest, all dignified, and in fact, what the Commonwealth herself would command. For he knows what manner of prince he has ever hoped for, and he cannot show himself to us as other than what he himself had sought and desired. Indeed, if you should wish to consider those monsters of old, a Nero, I mean, an Elagabalus, a Commodus, or rather, always, an Incommodus, you would assuredly find their vices were due as much to their youth as to the men themselves." So there's this debate, you know, we have these young emperors, and, you know, they weren't up to the task, so, you know, we need someone wise and experienced.
Okay.
And, you know, it's been suggested that this speech sort of reflects the time of writing of the HA, which is the late 4th century, when you do have children essentially ruling the empire, and so this actually reflects
a bit of criticism about the current leadership.
Exactly, you know, people like Arcadius and Honorius, for example. But it's interesting that this is the flip side, because if you read Tacitus's histories all the way back in AD 69, when he talks about Galba coming to power, you know, there's the number of ways that Tacitus finds to criticize his age is just incredible.
Yeah.
You know, he's pliant, he does what other people think, you know, he's indecisive, you know, and then it says, you know, he's old, left, right, and center. So it's this discourse that could go either way. And, you know, the HA, possibly because of its contemporary political resonance, is playing up the wise old man.
So one way around this argument seems to be what Tacitus has done, which is reassure people about his succession plans.
Yes. According to the HA, he says he won't appoint one of his sons as his successor, the idea is that the state will continue to choose the best man.
Mm.
Now, these sons are not known from any other source. I mean, it's plausible that a man of 75 would have sons and grandchildren, but they're not on record. But again, this is like echoes of Galba. Galba says, you know, I'm going to choose Piso as my successor. I'm not going to choose someone out of my family.
Yeah.
You know, like those Julio-Claudians, you know, they're all incestuous and appoint the wrong people and they adopt the wrong people. I'm going to choose a man from the entire state, from the Commonwealth.
Mm.
And so this is reflecting that idea, which we find throughout Roman history, is that, you know, sometimes perhaps it's the best man that should succeed, not a dynastic heir.
Okay, so what was Tacitus's first acts as emperor then?
We know Aurelian was deified. He becomes Divus Aurelianus. And so presumably this was his first thing that he did to establish this continuity with his predecessor. And certainly, you know, obviously Aurelian was murdered by some elements in his army, but he was still, you know, a major figure who, you know, successfully united the empire. So this establishment of continuity was very successful. The HA also talks about him being incredibly generous, bequeathing books to libraries. You know, the HA makes up this fictitious lineage from the historian Tacitus, and, you know, he donates
His
hands. Yes, yes. I mean, it's too irresistible to ignore. I mean, you know, I'm sorry for bringing up the historian Tacitus earlier, because that's probably just confused everyone.
Mm.
And, you know, when I'm teaching, I have to say, this is the emperor, this is the historian, you know, at different periods.
Yeah.
But he emerges very much as this Cuvilius Princeps, the emperor who behaves as if he were a fellow citizen, you know, giving generous benefits. Actions to the people. And then he does the right sort of thing that a third century emperor is supposed to do. You know, he takes the field in command of his troops. And this is because we are getting the invasion of what we call the Black Sea Goths, who are attacking Roman territory.
Can we backtrack slightly here? I mean, I know that the Historia Augusta makes up a lot.
Yes.
But I do quite like the author of the Historia Augusta citing a reference to an ivory book of decrees he found in the Ulpian Library, signed by Tacitus's own hand.
Yes.
The first-hand account of I went to the library and I found this book and it's signed by Tacitus's hand.
Yes, yes.
Talk on that, because I quite like those sort of things and go, well, you know, that points to all of this being true.
Yes.
First-hand research, primary source.
I know.
What's your problem, Caleb?
I know, I know. Why am I such a skeptic? Unfortunately, a lot of the things that the HA makes up that are claims to autopsy, they went there personally, or they saw in this library, or this person said that, or I found this letter which says this. They can be shown to be fake for various reasons. So one of the key reasons is that a lot of these documents refer to military commands and provinces which we know not to exist in the late 3rd century. They exist in the late 4th century. And so this is a big anachronism which casts doubt on all the other claims to autopsy.
Okay.
And a lot of the historians that the author cites for evidence are also fake. There's no other record of them. And the names of senators that he very often cites are names of people that existed in the late 4th century, not in the earlier period. Now, it may be that in, you know, 20 years, someone will find something in the Vatican library. They'll prove me wrong, and I would love that. That would be so exciting, because it's clear the author of the HA did do genuine research. Like, for example, the references to invasions are clearly based on Dexippus's lost history. But I think what the author has done is that they've taken these genuine references and then sort of filled out their narrative with all these fake references. And I shouldn't say this isn't unique to the HA. I mean, even in the late Republic, we have authors, you know, like Cicero complaining that families are inventing their family history because those things happened back in the 5th century BC and there's no record of them. And so there's these sort of falsified histories there. A scholar called Ernst Badian has written about what he calls the expansion of the past in the early Republic. The idea is they only have this much information and the rest is sort of traditions or fabrication.
This is where you get myth from, really.
Exactly. So I'm not saying the HA is alone in this. Mm. They're actually in this proud Roman historiographical tradition, really.
No, despite the fact that they are quite obviously false, there's some things in here that I really enjoy. So I'm going to keep coming back to it. Sorry.
Of course, no problem. It's fun work and we should study it more.
Just needs that really big asterisk next to it. This, for example, gives away his money, orders his house destroyed and public baths puts in its place.
Yes.
I mean, I don't care how good an emperor you are. You are not doing that.
No emperor would destroy his own house to do that. Yes.
But having said that, let's talk about military, which is going to be a highlight of his career right away, as it is for all emperors. Let's see how a 75-year-old goes on the battlefield.
Yeah, so he goes to Thrace, he takes command of Aurelian's army, he avenges Aurelian's death. Eros, the secretary who tricked everyone with the death list, was tied to a stake and ravaged by wild beasts. However, there are some suggestions that some of the murderers escaped his grasp because they actually come back later in the next episode to cause trouble during the reign of Probus. So we'll come back to that. But the most pressing issue is the Black Sea Goths. So I'll just quote Zenarus, one of our Greek historians here. The Scythians, having crossed Lake Maeotis and the Phasis River, attacked Pontus, Cappadocia, Galatia, and Cilicia. Tacitus, who had joined battle with them, and Florianus, who was prefect, slew many, and the remainder sought safety in flight. So this is Zenarus, book 12, chapter 28, and the Scythians is like this catch-all term in Greek historiography, you know, going back to Herodotus, for anyone from this region of the Ukraine, essentially modern-day Ukraine.
Mm.
And we call them in modern scholarship the Black Sea Goths, because Lake Maeotis is the Sea of Azov in the Ukraine, near the Crimea, and the Phasis River is a river in modern-day Georgia. So they move down south through the Black Sea, through the Caucasus, and then we know that they basically ravaged all of modern-day Turkey. So Cilicia is on the southern coast of Turkey, very, very near to Syria.
Mm.
And so Tacitus, together with his Praetorian prefect, Marcus Annius Florianus, they achieved significant victories to relieve the pressure on the people of Asia Minor against the Black Sea Goths. There is this remarkable inscription from Perge. So this is the southeastern coast of Turkey. And this is a series of inscribed acclamations. So acclamation is when everyone in the senate of the city or the entire population of the city would gather together and they would shout positive praise for the emperor and for local officials. So it's like a group chant, essentially.
Mm.
And sometimes emperors were there, but they would still shout acclamations even when emperors weren't there. And then often they reported back to emperors. So in Perge, these acclamations were actually inscribed, so preserved for posterity. And I'll just read these acclamations. Up with Perge, which alone has the right of asylum. Up with Perge, to whom Tacitus, and then it gets a bit fragmentary. Up with Perge, temple warden of the imperial cult since Vespasian. Up with Perge, honoured with a sacred vexillum. Up with Perge, honoured with silver coinage.
I'm sorry, this sounds like something that you'd sing when you're drunk in the local arena watching the show.
Up with Perge, temple warden of the imperial cult since Vespasian. Hey. And they were actually often chanted in sporting arenas.
Yeah, yeah.
So, okay, right. Yeah, you're on the right. You're
hey,
the right
up track. With Perge.
I've never heard them read out like that before, but it's probably more accurate.
Next time you teach these in class, get a drink beforehand.
Exactly.
Paint your face. Oh, chest. Yeah. Off you go.
Oh my goodness. Don't traumatize the students. So they would come together, and this suggests that Tacitus granted them some sort of benefaction or freed them and protected them. Unfortunately, you know, the precise part of the inscription is lost.
Or throughout the opening pitch.
Or probably more like, you know, release the wild beasts or something like that, you know, pulled up the gate.
Slew the first gladiator.
Yeah, exactly. The equivalent of a baseball pitch. Yeah. And then also, The sacred Wexillum, so Wexillum is a military flag, so it seems that perhaps there's a military detachment posted there for their protection against the Goths.
Mm.
And they also have the right to mint silver coinage. Most Greek cities only minted bronze coinage, so they may have been given the right to mint silver coinage to pay the troops there. So it's clear that Tacitus's presence in the area made a positive impact. You know, they wanted emperors to be on the scene protecting them. And we know that he took the title Gothicus Maximus, greatest conqueror of the Goths, for his successors in Asia Minor. He's doing pretty well.
Mm, he's doing pretty well until he's not. He doesn't have a very long reign.
No.
We've got 1 year and change.
Yes, I'm sorry, he's about to die.
All right. So how does he stop doing well?
Well, he's actually murdered in July 276. So this is probably at Tyana in Cappadocia in Turkey. The account in Zosimus, our Greek source, Book 1, Chapter 63, is very confused. This states that he had given the government of Syria to his relative Maximinus, who was so harsh and unpopular that the Syrians conspired with Aurelian's assassins and murdered him, and then they murdered Tacitus himself. How did they do this? You know, Syria, Cappadocia. Well, Zonaris, another Greek source, says that they killed Maximinus in Syria, then travelled to Asia Minor to kill Tacitus before he took retribution on them.
That feels excessive.
Yeah, so murderers have to get from Thrace, where Aurelian is murdered, to Syria, and then back to Cappadocia to kill Tacitus. It's very convoluted.
Yeah.
So it may have been a conspiracy, which has been garbled. Another story in both the HA and the Epitome De Casaribus is that he died of a disease.
Mm.
He's old, you know, campaigning may have taken its toll, so we don't know. We know, however, that unlike the case of Aurelian, a new successor is proclaimed on the spot. And this is Tacitus' Praetorian prefect, Marcus Annius Florianus. And we know that he's recognized back in Rome and throughout most of the Western provinces due to coins and inscriptions. The news gets around very fast. Unfortunately, however, a general in Syria called Marcus Aurelius Probus is proclaimed emperor by his troops.
Mm.
And Florianus only rules 88 days. Because he is murdered by the soldiers in Tarsus, also in southern. So he doesn't even get to leave southern Turkey because his soldiers are throwing their lot in with Probus.
That was Associate Professor Kaelin Davenport, head of the Centre for Classical Studies at the Australian National University. And you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, please subscribe in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or any readily available podcatching platform. Leave a review and maybe tell your friends about it. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can also follow us on the Desecrated Remains of Twitter. Kaelin is at Dr. C. Davenport, I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. That's it today for Emperors of Rome, so until the next episode, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.